Judges chapter 6, verse 33. We're going to pick up there. Midianites, Amalekites, and Edomites gathered together, crossed over the Jordan, and camped in the Jezreel Valley. The Spirit of the Lord enveloped Gideon, and he blew the ram's horn in the Abiezrites' valley behind him. He sent messengers throughout all of Manasseh, who rallied behind him. He also sent messengers throughout Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, who also came to meet him. Then Gideon said to God, "If you will deliver Israel by my hand, as you said, I will put a wool fleece here on the threshing floor. If dew is only on the fleece and all the ground is dry, I will know that you will deliver Israel by my strength, as you said." And that's what happened. He got up early in the morning and squeezed the fleece and wrung dew out of it, pulling a bowl of water. Gideon then said to God, "Don't be angry with me. Let me speak one more time. Please allow me to make one more test with the fleece. Let it remain dry and the dew be all over the ground." Baal, that is Gideon, and all the troops who were with him got up early and camped beside the spring of Harod. And Gideon was north of them, below the river Horeb, the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many troops for me to hand the Midianites over to them, or else Israel might elevate themselves over me and say, 'My own strength saved me.' Now announce the troops. Whoever is fearful and trembling may turn back and move on Gilead." So 22,000 of the troops turned back, but 10,000 remained. Then the Lord said to Gideon, "There are still too many troops. Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. If I say to you, 'This one can go with you,' you can go. If I say about anyone, 'This one cannot go with you,' you cannot go." So he brought the troops down to the water, and the Lord said to Gideon, "Separate everyone who laps water with his tongue like a dog." The same with everyone who fails to drink. And the number of those who lapped with their hands their mouths was all the rest of the troops knelt to put the water. The Lord said to Gideon, "I will deliver you with the 300 men who lapped, and the Midianites over to you. Everyone else is to go home." So Gideon sent all the Israelites to their tents, and kept the 300 troops who took the provisions and their trumpets. And the Midian was below him in the valley. That night the Lord said to him, "Get up and attack the camp, for I have handed it over to you. If you're afraid to attack the camp, go down with Purah, your servant. Listen to what they say, and then you'll be encouraged to attack the camp." So he went down with Purah, his servant, the outpost of the troops who were in the camp. Now the Midianites, Amalekites, and all the Canaanites had settled down in the valley like a swarm of locusts, and the camels were as innumerable as sand on the seashore. When Gideon arrived, there was a man telling his friend about a dream. He said, "Listen, I had a dream. A loaf of barley bread came tumbling as the Midianite camp struck the tent, and it fell. The loaf turned the tent upside down, so it collapsed." His friend answered, "This is nothing less than the sword of Gideon, son of Joash, the Israelite. God has handed the entire Midianite camp over to me." When Gideon heard the account of the dream and its interpretation, he bowed in worship. He returned to Israel's camp and said, "Get up, for the Lord has handed the Midianite camp over to me." And he divided the 300 men into three companies, and gave each of them a trumpet in one hand, and an empty pitcher, and then put a torch in it in the other. "Watch me," he said to them, "and do what I do. If I come to the outpost of the camp, do as I do. When I and everyone with me blow our trumpets, you are to blow your trumpets all around the camp. And you will say, 'For the Lord,' and for Gideon." Gideon and the men who were with him went to the outpost of the camp, beginning the middle watch, after the sentries were stationed. They blew their trumpets and broke the pitchers that were in their hands. Three companies blew their trumpets and shattered their pitchers. They held their torches in the left hands, and their trumpets in the right hands, and shouted, "The sword for the Lord of Gideon." Each Israelite took his position around the camp, and the entire Midianite army began to run, and they cried out as they fled. Gideon's men blew their 300 7, in which Gideon and the 300 defeat a much larger army, is another example of this. The heading in the New King James Version, Gideon's Valiant 300, says it all. Another very well-known evangelical expositor uses this passage to justify his church's decision to build a congregation wing without incurring any debt. Apparently, since the passage shows that God loves difficult and unusual challenges, waiting until all the money came in before they started the build would make it more challenging to God, and therefore he would get more glory. That's probably good sense, I think, not to incur debt before a building program, but I'm not quite sure how that reading of this passage is supposed to work. I mean, to me, that could sound more like Gideon starting out with 300 men and then trusting God to send the remaining 32,000 before he began the battle. And that's not even to mention the common evangelical practice of laying out fleeces, asking God to give us providential signs to direct our daily decisions for us or large. Clearly, there's a lot of confusion about this passage. So let's see if we can illuminate this a little bit today. We begin by recapping the story from last week. The Israelites had sinned, and the Lord handed them over into the power of the Midianites and Amalekites, nomadic raiders from the east, who had swept over the land like locusts, stripping it clean of all of its produce. And then after 7 years, the people cried out for the Lord, and the Lord sent a prophet, not to set apart a deliverer, as the prophet destined in chapter 4, but to rebuke Israel for their fickleness. They'd been following other gods most of the time, and yet they were still calling on the Lord to help them when they were in distress. As we saw last week, the expected word of judgment does not come. Instead, the camera cuts the angel of the Lord, the personal representation of the representative of God, who is commissioning Gideon to deliver people. And Gideon immediately disputes what the angel is saying. He disputes, first of all, the angel's description of him as a valiant warrior, and then he disputes the angel's statement that he is with Israel. But then, after receiving a sign from the angel of the Lord, he builds an altar, ending in the Lord is peace. And he tells him, not so much of that peace, to tear down the father's Baal altar, which he does at night, rather than during the day, because he's afraid he's going to be in the city. And of course, the Israelites realize that it's Gideon who's done this, they want to put him to death. Gideon's father, ironically, priest of Baal, intervenes and says, well, let Baal contend for himself, for his own honor. After all, Baal is a god, he shouldn't need people to save him, he should be the one to save the people. That's how God got last week. The story picks up with the return of Israel's enemies, the Midianites, Amalekites, and Kedemites from the east, who crossed the Jordan last spring and encamped to the wide Jezreel Valley, not far from Gideon's hometown of Ophrah. At this point, we read the Spirit of the Lord put on Gideon, as if it were some kind of garment, and as a result, Gideon sounded the shofar, the ram's horn, for battle, gathering not only his own clan, the Abiezrites, but men from Manasseh and Asher and Zebulun and Naphtali. And the result is a mighty army, 32,000 men. This is far more than the 10,000 that Barak had assembled at Mount Tabor. It's a remarkable testimony to the Lord's work, especially if Gideon really is from the least, in his family. His family didn't support the land of Manasseh, as he claimed. So you think, right, we're ready for the battle now, right? Well, not quite. Before he leads the army out to war, Gideon wants a sign that the Lord is with him. Now notice carefully, it's not that Gideon is unclear or confused about what he's supposed to do. Twice, in verses 36 and 37, he acknowledges that God had said that he would what makes you think that the 300 men he picks have to be the best bunch? Well, you might think, okay, now we're ready for battle. Gideon's been reassured from multiple sides, the army's been reduced to a size where surely any victory has to be the Lord's doing, and the Lord tells Gideon, get up, attack the camp, for I've handed it over to you. Then there's another delay, because the Lord adds, if you're afraid to attack the camp, go down with four of your servants, listen to what they have to say, and then you'll be encouraged. And what happens next? There he is, going down the outpost of Midian camp, with his servant Korah, obviously still afraid, in spite of the Lord's assurances. Now spare a thought for Gideon here. He's not crazy to be afraid. The Midianites, Amalekites, and Canaanites have assembled a massive force with their military edge on full display. In the shape of camels, there's innumerable as sand on the seashore. And remember, his biblical history, that very metaphor, would have encouraged him. The Lord promised Abraham in Genesis 22 that his offspring would be as numerous as sand on the seashore, and he would possess the gates of his enemies. And in Joshua 11, the Lord gave his people victory over forces numerous as sand on the seashore. Then when Gideon got to the camp, he overheard a man telling his friend his dream, in which a loaf of barley bread came tumbling into the camp, struck one of the tents, and destroyed it. Well, it's obvious what the dream means, his friend says. The loaf is the sword of God, or the sword of Gideon, and the gods have handed the Midianite camp over to him. It's not so obvious in our translation why a loaf should represent the sword of Gideon, and why the tent necessarily has to be Midianite. There's got to be some wordplay in Hebrew that explains all of that. There's really no explanation as to why he fastens on this interpretation of the dream, rather than seeing Midian as the golden loaf that he is right now being destroyed. The Lord is at work disheartening Israel's enemies, at the same time as encouraging Gideon through this dream. Don't miss the sad irony in this transaction. Gideon will not believe the direct word of God spoken personally to him by the angel of the Lord, backed up by miraculous signs. He does not believe as a result of two separate fleece signs given to him at his request by the Lord, but when he hears one pagan interpreting another bizarre dream to another, that's what finally convinces him that God can be trusted. Well, at least he is convinced. Turned Israelite camp and delivered the man the instruction he had received from the Lord all the way back in verse 9. Get up! The Lord has handed the Midianite camp over to you. And he divided his small army into three divisions and armed each of them with a shofar and a lenten pitcher and a torch. Thus the Lord fought for them. There was no chance of victory against such a vastly superior force, even with the element of surprise on their side. Earlier hesitancy and fear is now gone, though. Gideon led his men from the front, instructing them to follow his personal example. There's one misquoted note in the book of victory. When they came to the outpost at the edge of the Midianite camp, Gideon instructed his men to blow their trumpets and shout as their battle cry, "For the Lord!" And Gideon, "No! Comparing the Lord's name with that of Gideon is all wrong here. This is a battle in which the Lord has taken great pains to make clear that it will be won by his might alone, greatly reducing the size of the Israelite army so that the Israelites would not be able to boast. He should just have shouted, "For the Lord!" Stop himself. His own name. Well, the strategy worked out exactly as he planned. Beginning at the middle watch of the night, about midnight, Gideon's three groups blew their trumpets and broke their pitchers, shouting their battle cry, in case you missed it earlier, "A sword for the Lord!" And Gideon. That obviously sounded like a much larger army. And the elements of surprise combined with divinely induced fear sent the Midianites fleeing for their lives, fighting one another in confusion. Well, the victory was not simply the result of successful military psychology. It was the Lord set the Midianites towards against one another. Then the surviving Midianites fled towards the Jordan River, which formed the barrier between them and their home territory, Transjordan. And at this point, with victory assured, Gideon called out the men of Naphtali and Asher and Gad, the original remnants of his original army of 40,000 men, to join the pursuit. And he also summoned Ephraim to seize the fords across the Jordan River to cut off the retreat for the remnants of Midian. It seems somewhat discordant with the spirit of this holy war for Gideon to call for reinforcements now, after the Lord has already won the victory with a smaller force. The fords of the Jordan, Ephraim captured two of the Midianite chieftains, Oreb and Zeeb, put them to death and brought the evidence of their triumph to Gideon. And that, you might think, that was the time for the great to close off Gideon's story with a note about the years of rest that Israel enjoyed during his lifetime. Well, that notice doesn't come for another whole chapter. Gideon did not live happily ever after, nor did the people. But that part of the story is perhaps great to the next week's Sunday. So what is this passage about? What does it have to teach us? By now, it should be clear that this story is not about how to seek God's guidance when you're perplexed by laying out a fleece. Gideon knew exactly what he should do all along. He had a hard time believing God would really be with him. Nor is this passage about building programs and deliberately choosing a more difficult way to do something because then God would be more glorified. Gideon didn't deliberately choose to do things the harder way. The Lord doesn't always force that path on people. He didn't insist on Barak sending half his army home. Sometimes he can save by many, and other times by few. But both of those mistaken meanings come from seeing Gideon as a hero for us to imitate, rather than as a flawed and sometimes weak leader, who God nonetheless used to bring about the deliverance of his people. Doubly ironic to treat Gideon as the hero of the narrative if the subpoint throughout is Gideon's repeated attempt to make this story about him as well as the Lord. It's as if we're joining Israel in shouting the same flawed battle cry for the Lord and for Gideon. Well, that observation comes to see what the last of the story actually is. The book of Judges, like Kyle, much later than the events it describes, time of social and religious chaos, or again, doing what was right in their own eyes. Certainly, Manasseh. At a time like that, when God's people were in moral and social chaos, the northern kingdom already in exile, the temptation was very real to doubt if God was with us. Manasseh's made its inheritance. Could they still count on God's promises? Would God still be with them? Weak though they were, there's lots of similar questions later in their own history, including this story about the times of the Judges. Israel had sinned before and pursued idols, abandoned the Lord and brought them out of the land of Egypt. And even while the prophets then also warned of the dangerous path they were on, God still raised up Venus for them, providing a measure of deliverance in spite of their personal sins. All because the Lord was still with them, and always would be still with those who were his people. But in the midst of God's faithfulness and kindness to his people, when he granted deliverance and victory, they were still blinded by the sin of themselves. How does that play out in our experience? Like Israel, we too are regularly sidetracked by our idols. And suddenly when we find ourselves in trouble, now the Lord is with us. Like Gideon, we often know exactly what it is God would have us do, but we don't want to do it. So we come up with endless excuses and reasons why we can't possibly do it unless God gives us solid proof that he'll be with us. God spoke to Gideon clearly through the angel of the Lord, and God has spoken to us clearly through the scriptures. Of course, there are often situations in life that are perplexing. But out, suddenly the story becomes about us and how when we chose to trust God, amazing things happened. this story is not a long history of obedience in the same direction. It's a history of failure, idolatry, sin. A history in which even God-ordained, Spirit-empowered leaders fall into the temptation of thinking of themselves as God's gifted people. The history that should have humbled them instead so often bounced off their backs. by faith perfectly in our place. So that now when God looks at us, he does not see our halting, Gideon-like struggles. Instead, he sees victory. Remember when we shouted, "For the Lord and for me"?